Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why some universities, including one in Arizona, are offering three-year bachelor's degrees.
And seeking the threshold of panic when the human body is exposed to extreme heat.
But first, Arizona Democrats have elected a new party chair. Again. In January, Democrats elected Robert Branscombe to replace Yolanda Bejarano as head of the state party. But 6 months later, members voted to oust Branscombe amid party infighting and controversies over fundraising and other issues. This past weekend, Democrats elected former state lawmaker and state House minority leader Charlene Fernandez the new party chair. She won with 58% of the vote over four other candidates. And she takes over a party that is losing ground in terms of voter registration and that had a disappointing showing in last year's election. Fernandez came by the studio earlier this week, and I asked her about those voter registration numbers showing people leaving the Democratic Party and what she plans to do about that.
Well, I think some are leaving to be independent, mm-hmm. to the independent party. And I think we have to tell that story about who we are. We have forgotten to tell the story of, you know, the Affordable Care Act. Over 44 million people, a million Americans are on the Affordable Care Act right now. That was a Democrat that put that into place. We have to tell those stories. That's what Democrats do. Think about Social Security. How many million Americans are on Social Security?
Well, so then I guess is the question then the message or maybe the messenger, because you talk about the Affordable Care Act. That's been in effect for a while now. Mm-hmm. I mean, Social Security decades before that. And, you know, President Biden thought that he could win re-election based on some of the initiatives that he championed and got through Congress during his term. And that didn't work. And even with the Affordable Care Act there, you know, people are leaving the Democratic Party in higher numbers than they are leaving the Republican Party. So I guess, like, what's the disconnect there?
You have to constantly remind them. And I think for a lot of young individuals, they don't think that applies to them. We need to talk to them about, you know, home ownership. You know, the fact that many of them are getting out of college, saddled in debt. What can we do about that? So we need to start reminding kids that we've done it before and we'll do it again.
What is an Arizona Democrat right now? And I ask because there's been so much talk about, like, the brand of Democrats, not just in Arizona, but nationally, not being all that great, right? That, you know, people don't have necessarily great perception of the Democratic Party. So how do you define a Democrat in Arizona?
Well, we're all over. We are so independent and diverse. You know, you go into my area, Yuma County, very, very ag oriented. So water is real important. So we see a lot of Democrats in that area that wear the boots and the bolo tie and are working out there making sure that water gets to the lettuce and that it's cultivated, right? We have to make sure that the workforce is there. And then you come up to Phoenix, it's a whole different ballgame about what Democrats look like and what they need and what their priorities are. So our messaging has to reach a diverse group of people. And I'm sure this is for the Republican Party too, but our messaging has to match what our Democrats look like.
So do you think that in the past then, maybe the recent past, that messaging just hasn't been there?
I think we took it for granted that everyone knew. You know, I was with the Biden administration for 3 years and we did unbelievable things. You know, if I named some of them, you'd probably say, what? So I think we have forgotten to share that story.
I'm curious about your perception of sort of the factions within the Democratic Party, not just in Arizona, of course, because we've seen this nationally as well, but, you know, sort of, you know, the more progressive left-wing side versus the more centrist moderate side. How do you try to bring everybody together, especially right now when there's so much debate over what the response should be from Democrats to the Trump administration and some of the things that they're doing?
Absolutely. I know that's a problem. The thing is we've never been in lockstep. As long as I have been a Democrat, we've been free thinkers. And maybe that's our downfall. Maybe that's why our registration's going down, because we don't walk in lockstep. We don't think in lockstep. I find it an advantage. You know that I was a minority leader at the Arizona State Legislature. It was 15-14. We had the largest caucus, Democratic caucus, in years, 29 of us. But every day it was 15-14, 15-14. Very different areas all of us were representing. But when it was important, we came together. So I'm hoping I can bring that same idea to the Arizona Democrats, that we can argue, we can fight, we can have different ideas. I love that we have left and we have, you know, the ones that are not so progressive. I love it. But we have to come together when it's important for the people of Arizona.
So how do you try to figure out when it is important enough to do that? And how do you try to convince the different groups of Democrats, guys, this is important. We need to rally around this.
Well, let's take, again, the legislature. I feel that's what I know. Right now, we're very close to being in the majority, not as close as we were when I was there, but we're pretty close. And I think we can take the majority. And that's going to be important. That's going to be critical. We could change the face of Arizona if we took the majority. So I think when we start talking about what can happen when we come together, we'll make great strides.
There's been a lot of reporting over the past few months about the state of the finances of the Democratic Party. I'm curious how you're finding them and how you're planning to try to build them up.
It's all doable. You know, we had a few months where, you know, there wasn't any fundraising. We're back on track. We, you know, had a successful function just last Friday, not even a week, and we, you know, it was packed. We know people are coming back. We're hearing from them. Yeah, we're in a good place.
What are the challenges you're facing sort of coming in midstream? I mean, we're less than a year away from the primaries for the midterms and, you know, just a little more than a year away from the general election. And here you are just, you know, days on the job. Like, that seems like an awful lot to try to take in all at once and get up to speed very quickly.
You know, it is tough. The exciting part, Mark, is that we'll be able, whatever we do, any small thing we do, we'll be able to quantify and say, we didn't have this before, and now this is where we're at. So I think we have to look at it in the positive. I'm real excited to be here. I keep telling the staff that this is campaign work on steroids. We're just looking at November 2026. We've got our marching orders. We got to make sure that our governor is elected on election night, that our attorney general is elected on election night, our secretary of state is elected on election night, and every other one of the Democrats are elected. We're going to run someone in every single district in this state, legislative district in the state. It's a reason for Democrats to come out. So we want to make sure we get homegrown people to run for the legislature and get Democrats out to vote.
How much do you think the Democrats' messaging should be, as you were discussing before, things like the Affordable Care Act, other policies that Democrats have put in place that, you know, people generally seem to like? And how much of the message should be, we're not Trump?
Probably both, you know, 50-50. We're not Trump. You know, we're able to go out into these rural communities and make sure that we're getting messaging there to talk about what they had before Trump came in. And I know what they had. I was rural development state director. I know what was happening in these rural communities, and now it's not happening. So we can talk about that. But no, and don't think we're going to lay back. You know, we're going to fight this tooth and nail. We're going to fight to win. This is not going to be easy. By no means is this going to be easy. I think we can talk about the great things we've done and we could do once we get back in four years, when we get back in the White House, 3 years, and what can happen if we take over the legislature and we send at least two more Democrats from Arizona to the U.S. Congress. We need to put those guardrails up. We do not want anyone touching our Social Security. We do not want anyone touching our Medicare or Medicaid or, you know, the Department of Education. We want to make sure that when we need immunizations for our children and for our elderly, that they're there. So I want to keep, you know, make sure that we talk about those things. Maybe I haven't said Trump, but I'm telling you, we're going to fight it tooth and nail.
All right. That is Charlene Fernandez, the new chair of the Arizona Democratic Party. Charlene, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. This was wonderful.
And let's turn now to our neighbors to the east.
New Mexico made history last week when it became the first state in the country to make child care free for everyone. The state already offers universal pre-K for 3- and 4-year-olds, and they already had an expansive child care program that would subsidize care for anyone making up to 400% of the poverty level, about $124,000 a year. But now, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has removed the income eligibility requirement, and anyone working or in school in the state can qualify. They expect the program to save New Mexico families $12,000 a year. But it hasn't come easily. And it won't be cheap. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke more about it with Elizabeth Griginski, Cabinet Secretary for New Mexico's Early Childhood Education and Care Department, which was created in 2019.
Tell us about the reaction to this. Like, do people who make over that 400% of the poverty level say that they need this kind of assistance?
They absolutely do need it. We've heard from two educators here in Santa Fe who were thinking they may have to leave the state because they make just over that 400% income and they have a 16-month-old child. Their child care costs them $1,200 a month. Mm. In most communities in New Mexico and probably across the country, the child care bill is as high, if not higher, than mortgage and rent for most families. Oftentimes, families negotiate who can work, who can't, who can stay home, always concerned about how to make the child care expense work. And so we see this as freeing up families to realize their full potential while supporting young children to be in these healthy, high quality, safe learning environments.
Right. Talk a little bit about what this has looked like in the last 5 years since this department began. I mean, you're trying to solve a problem that is, you know, universal. Like, this is a problem that exists across the country in terms of the soaring costs of childcare that just seem to be going up and the need to actually fill the positions to do it, right? Like, finding enough providers to do it. How have you tackled that in terms of creating, I guess, the infrastructure to do it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. One thing that we've done here in New Mexico, we were the first state in the country to use a cost alternative methodology for establishing our rates to pay childcare. And what that allowed us to do was to look at the true cost of delivering care. We're looking at all the costs, our licensing regulations that providers incur, but also other state laws like mandatory sick time for employees in small businesses. So we put all of that into a model and we set our rates. First time we did it, we set the floor for entry-level staff at $12.10 because that was the highest minimum wage in the state in 2021. Mm-hmm. We then updated it in 23 to $15 as a floor. But right away, we saw post-pandemic salaries for most jobs were starting at 17 and 18. And so that's what we've done with this recent proposed rate increase, is setting that floor at 18 for entry-level staff. Our results have shown great progress. We've had a 64% growth in our early childhood professionals compared to the rest of the country, where it's declined by about 7%.
So paid them more and they came in, basically.
Yes, we paid them fair wages for the value of their work. Should they be higher? People could argue that, but we have set a trajectory in this state to pay our early childhood professionals.
So let me ask you about the money then. I mean, this must be an astronomical amount of money in a way to think about trying to not only pay child care providers much more than they're already being paid, to expand this program so that it's universal and anybody can get in. How is the state going about funding this?
Yes, I've been very smart in this state. Our governor and our legislature have made incredibly wise investments. In 2020, the governor created the Early Childhood Trust Fund, and the legislature put $300 million in there. And it's funded through surplus oil and gas revenues, federal mineral leasing. That fund has now grown to nearly $10 billion.
Wow.
It's the interest off that fund that supports the work of the Early Childhood Education and Care Department. So in 2026, we have about a little over $450 million to support child care assistance. That's a combination of the trust fund, general fund, and federal funds. We have asked for another $120 million for fiscal year 27. So that we can continue this promise to New Mexico families of a universal childcare system.
And that additional $120 million will have to be approved by the state legislature. This also, though, comes at a time when New Mexico is really being hard hit by federal funding cuts on a lot of fronts and in ways that many other states aren't. Is that playing a role here? Is that going to make this harder?
I think that the governor and the legislature are doing very smart things in terms of looking at what the federal landscape looks like, but also recognizing that when they created the department and they supported the trust fund, and then 70% of voters said, let's use a portion of our land grant to fund early childhood education and care, they know that this is the promise of better outcomes for all of our families, better health, better education, better social outcomes. When we start early and give families and young children the quality experiences they need, deserve, and want, we are going to see an improved outcome, a 13% return on that investment. And our lieutenant governor said it well. These are not expenditures. These are investments we're making in New Mexico families and in our human capital.
It's interesting because it is being framed as an economic investment, and in this economic way, there are obviously critics of this program and this expansion, people who say we should focus on, you know, the low-income families who need it most, the kids most at risk of abuse or neglect, and there are concerns about the cost of this going forward. Is this sustainable in the long term?
Yes, it is sustainable, and we share that concern, and we are releasing a request for proposal this week for contracted slots for infants and toddlers, specifically for low-income children and children with special needs. And the governor has put $13 million into a low-interest loan, revolving loan fund, to help childcare businesses access capital to build their supply, because we know we need more supply. Mm-hmm. And again, the return for this investment is tenfold. And we look forward to being able to share those results with others in other states. We're getting a lot of calls from across the country, which right. is very exciting.
That leads me to my final question, which is this sort of a model in your mind for what other states should be or could be doing? I mean, I wonder if you hope that this changes the game, changes the conversation around what's even possible in the realm of funding childcare.
We absolutely do. The governor sees it as a model. We see it as a model, and we hope, we hear from everyone, you've given us hope. There is a way to do this, and it's about putting families at the center of your policymaking.
All right. We will leave it there. Secretary Elizabeth Groginski, the Cabinet Secretary for New Mexico's Early Childhood Education and Care Department, joining us. Thank you very much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we'll hear from guitarist John Scofield about his journey in jazz.
But first, a growing number of colleges and universities around the country are offering three-year bachelor's degrees. That includes Northern Arizona University. The State Board of Regents earlier this year approved Bachelor of Professional Studies programs in Hospitality Business Administration and Engineering Technology. These degrees require 90 credits instead of the usual 120, and not only are schools offering them, but accrediting agencies are approving them. Joanna Alonzo, admissions and enrollment reporter at Inside Higher Ed, has written about this. I spoke with her earlier, and we started with what's behind this trend of colleges and universities offering these three-year bachelor's degrees.
Yeah, well, it's something that's been talked about for well over a decade now. And the main point is just to help students get their degrees quicker and get them into the job market quicker and for less money. And it's been tried in a few different ways, including just letting students take more courses or take summer courses to finish up more quickly. But my article focused a little bit more on actually cutting down on the number of credits and therefore the number of classes that students need to graduate.
Yeah, obviously, you know, as you say, you know, it takes less time, it's less expensive. I wonder, though, if there is a concern that if you are taking fewer classes and getting fewer credit hours, are you learning as much as maybe you would want to or need to in 3 years versus four?
Yeah, that is definitely sort of the key question on a lot of people's minds with regards to three-year degrees. So, yeah, a lot of people think that the liberal arts element of college, because electives are the thing that are going away in most cases, at most universities that have reduced credit degrees, the way they're getting that number down is by getting rid of electives. So No one's necessarily worried about the major being watered down because in most cases the major classes are exactly the same.
Okay.
But the electives, you don't have to take as many electives. And so it basically comes down to, are those an integral part of the higher ed experience and of the education? And if you don't take that, you're having a worse experience or you won't be ready for the job market. Versus some people feel they're a little superfluous, especially not in every case, but maybe for someone who's had a lot of life experience, they're not fresh out of high school. But, you know, it's contentious.
Yeah. Are there particular degrees or particular types of majors that are seeing these offerings in 3 years as opposed to four?
Well, when me and Bob Zemsky, who is sort of the founder of this idea, talked about it, he wanted to make it clear that he felt, you know, this could be done in a wide variety of majors and programs. However, to start out, a lot of colleges are primarily looking at this for pretty like professional programs like pre-physical therapy, cybersecurity, things of that nature. So at the moment, it's really, really skewing in that direction. And what Dr. Zemsky said was that he basically feels like at least part of this has to do with the fact that professors within like the humanities, he talked about history, which is his field specifically, are really reluctant to this idea and feel that, yeah, as we mentioned, it could devalue higher education. So I think right now it's definitely mostly in that professional space, but as we move forward, that could change. That definitely wasn't the original vision for it to only be for a very small set of majors.
Well, other than him, does it seem as though there is an effort to maybe expand it to more of sort of the classical liberal arts type majors?
To be honest, of the people I spoke with, it wasn't something that at least seemed top of mind. Hmm. When I spoke with people at universities, I spoke with the president of a university, and when I spoke with some accreditors, they didn't bring it up, and they seemed to, you know, when I asked about what kind of majors were being focused here, they seemed to feel that it's the easiest to map it onto some sort of professional program where, again, it doesn't feel like the liberal arts element is as intrinsic. Again, that is like open to interpretation, but, you know, there's sort of a sense that if you're studying pre-physical therapy, you're going to be a physical therapist. There could be more of a straight shot whereas if you're a history major, it's easier for a lot of people to see a relationship between history and whatever other sort of electives you're taking, say in music or, you know, the arts or something like that.
So you mentioned accreditors, and I'm curious mm-hmm. what you found about why those groups decided to get on board with this, because that's obviously a pretty big deal if universities want to be able to do this in any meaningful way.
Yeah, it's been a huge deal that accreditors are now on board. Last spring of 2024, very few accreditors were getting on board, but a few were just starting to move the needle. And now a lot, maybe all of the like major regional accreditors have some framework for allowing a college to introduce a reduced credit program. So speaking with them, they were mostly stressing just the fact that they, you know, they're not interested in being stuck in the past. They want to be able to innovate along with the universities that they accredit. But they, you know, like so many other people in this discussion, are concerned about the quality. And they're also, you know, looking out for students in terms of things like will graduate programs take a 3-year 90 credit bachelor's? So, for example, if you got a 90 credit cybersecurity degree and you want to go on to some sort of master's or PhD program, would you be able to get in with that degree? So that being said, no one knows exactly what the reactions are going to be and if they're going to be universal. You know, some graduate schools might say yes, some graduate schools might say no, or it might be a case-by-case basis. So it seems that across the board, what most of these large accreditors said was, we are definitely willing to give people a shot at this or give universities a shot to try this. But all of them sort of said, caveat, we definitely want to be measuring sort of the learning outcomes, as well as looking into things like, you know, how employers and graduate schools view these things. And most of them sort of said that if we approve such a program, we're doing it as something like a pilot where like they do check in with all programs on a regular basis, but they will be checking in on these programs in the future to make sure that they're sort of working out as they should.
How significant will those sort of check-ins be to determine how prevalent this becomes and maybe how much it expands to other universities and other programs?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that some universities, I should give the caveat that, you know, I didn't really talk to universities that aren't already considering this for this mm-hmm. program. That would definitely be an interesting thing to look at. But what I would expect would be that other universities will definitely be looking at this, at the successes of these first programs to see if it's something worth pursuing. Definitely in whether in 5 years they come out with strong outcomes. Also just looking at if these programs are popular, like is there any interest? One thing that also didn't make it into my article, but that I'm hoping to write about this fall, is that I did hear a couple people say sort of, we don't necessarily think students are going to flock to this. And then also, yes, looking at the learning outcomes and all that. And I should say, even if these programs aren't like excessively successful, that doesn't mean that colleges won't be interested in. But there's sort of, a level of interest and enrollment and interest from students that they'll have to get to sort of demonstrate to other colleges that their students might find value in this.
All right. That is Joanna Alonzo, admissions and enrollment reporter with Inside Higher Ed. Joanna, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is really fun.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Well, it's time now for another installment in our Throwing Shade series. And there's a pretty fundamental question that those of us who live here in the Valley have to ask ourselves in order to live here. How much heat can the body handle? We've all got our own answers to that question, but scientists are working hard to come up with a definitive answer. Rob Mead is one of those scientists. He's a research fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and recently he conducted what he calls a heat chamber experiment. The goal was to test the human body's ability to cope with extreme heat by exposing test subjects to temperatures at which they could no longer cool themselves or thermoregulate.
Yeah, so thermoregulation just simply is how the body regulates its temperature. So you can think of it basically at any given time, you know, the amount of heat being produced in the body needs to be balanced by how much heat the body is losing. So when we're exposed to hot conditions and we start to gain heat, or we exercise and we start to generate heat within the body, the body essentially needs to use strategies, sweating being one of them, to dissipate heat so that we can stay, you know, within the range of temperatures that's conducive to normal bodily function.
Got it. And so the idea behind the heat chamber study was to see at what point the body's natural mitigating abilities were no longer sufficient.
Yeah, exactly. The point at which we couldn't actually generate enough heat loss via sweating to counteract the amount of heat we were gaining from the environment.
And what did this look like exactly? Was there a literal heat chamber that you put people in?
Yeah. So quite a large heat chamber at the University of Ottawa. Essentially, what we did is we brought a group of young adults in. You can think of it like we stuck them in the chamber, and then we slowly increased the humidity to see which humidity at which, you know, core temperature would start to rise very rapidly. But what made our project different was then we brought them back in for prolonged visit, so about 9 hours, where we exposed people to conditions just above or just below that threshold we identified in the first part of the trial. So we could see, you know, above the estimated limit, did their core temperature stream upwards? And then below the limit, was it able to stabilize?
So were you like visually observing the participants while this was happening? Can you tell us what you saw?
Yes. So what we saw on the participants is, you know, the cardinal signs that someone is heat stressed, you know, flushed red faces. Obviously, they were sweating quite profusely. And then in that condition that I mentioned where conditions were hotter than each person's estimated threshold, what we saw was there'd be kind of a delay. You know, you get in the heat and it takes a little bit of time for the heat to start entering your body. But once it started, core temperature would just kind of stream upwards. And then most 8 of the 12 participants, we actually had to pull out of the heat at a core temperature of 39.2, which is about 103 Fahrenheit.
Uh-huh.
This was our kind of safety threshold for when to stop the trial.
Gotcha. Can I ask, I mean, did you have the opportunity to talk to any of the participants about what this was like you know, just anecdotally and individually for them? Because it sounds, I have to say, really intense. What kinds of things did they say when they came out of the chamber?
So I should add that I was also participated in the trial myself.
Oh, you did?
A pilot, you know.
Okay.
Yes, if you, I have a, you know, a kind of rule that if I'm going to ask someone to sit in these kind of conditions, I should probably also know what they feel like.
Oh, well, that you can tell us from your experience then.
Yeah, so everyone responds to heat a little bit differently. I would say agitation is pretty common across the board.
Yeah.
Time starts to move very slow. But the best way to describe it is you just feel your brain is just screaming, we need to get to a cool environment. We shouldn't be in this heat.
So, Rob, what were your findings based on the heat chamber study in terms of where that threshold in the human body is after which thermoregulation is no longer effective?
Yeah, so, you know, the actual limits for thermoregulation for prolonged heat tolerance in human are probably quite a bit lower than the theoretical 95 degree Fahrenheit, sorry, upper limit. The important thing to consider, though, when we're thinking about these limits is most of the research we've done on defining these new upper limits for thermoregulation has been conducted in relatively cool areas. So, for example, our study was in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. Most of the research has actually come out of Penn State University. So quite a temperate environment, and all of these studies use unacclimated participants. So I think where the real open question is how well do these new limits actually translate to areas that are, you know, more regularly heat exposed, places like Phoenix, but how much flexibility there is for acclimatization and regular heat exposure, I think is something we need to figure out pretty soon.
Yeah. And just to be clear, the way that you were able to theorize that the limits were lower than previously thought is because the subjects of your study were starting to lose the ability to thermoregulate at these lower limits.
Yeah, exactly. So our limit in the particular combination of conditions we used, it was around 32 degrees Celsius, about 89, 90 Fahrenheit. And exposing people just above this threshold, so not 35, it was around, you know, maybe a degree higher, mm-hmm. their core temperatures just streamed up and up and up until we had to pull 8 of 12 of them before they, you know, reached dangerous levels.
Yeah. So now that you have done this test, what do you think the implications are?
For one, it does actually seem like that the, you know, the temperatures at which humans can be exposed to for prolonged periods are much lower than previously thought. Phoenix is actually a really important case because dry environments, it seems like, could be potentially even more dangerous. And Phoenix obviously is quite dry.
And what is the reason for the higher level of danger in a drier environment?
So basically the two things that are going to affect how much sweat you can dissipate is, again, the humidity in the air, as well as, you know, how much sweat you can actually produce.
Right.
So you can kind of think of it simply as what this assumes is that you're completely coating the skin with sweat. And in dry environments, what we're limited by is our ability to sweat. And it turns out that humans actually can't, I guess, for all intents and purposes, coat the entire skin with sweat. Some of it will drip off, and any drip sweat doesn't actually contribute to heat loss. So it's because basically we're limited by how much sweat we can produce in dry environments, whereas in kind of warm but very humid environments, it's more of how much of that sweat is evaporating.
Got it. Did you look at all in this study at if somebody is in a very hot environment, did shade play any role in the study, or do you have any thoughts on its ability to mitigate some of these effects?
So in our specific study, we didn't consider shade or, you know, radiative heating, the type of heat gain we get from the sun. So our limits and most of the limits actually you see in this in kind of studies like ours are usually done not considering shade. Mm-hmm. Though shade is obviously very important because in most scenarios, individuals are exposed to sunlight. They are exposed to radiant heat sources, whether, you know, you're outdoors or you're getting sunlight through a window. And actually, sun can heat the body very quickly. Basically, the way you can think about it is these are limits in the shade, what we, you know, evaluated. But exposed to sunlight, these limits probably drop considerably.
When you look at the results of this study, what does it make you think about?
You know, we're already experiencing very extreme impacts of heat. The planet, by all accounts, is still warming. And if there's a chance that we can, you know, be exposed in the summer for prolonged periods to these high temperatures, you know, that we know we probably can't be exposed to for prolonged periods without adverse impacts. You know, this is something we really need to consider, because if these temperatures are coming, you know, this is potentially a very large public health problem.
Well, terrifying but important research from our guest, Rob Mead, who is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Rob, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For the first time ever, a lowrider parade in San Francisco will be televised on Saturday. Car clubs from across the country, including Arizona, will take to the streets of Calle 24 Latino Cultural District in more than 300 souped-up custom cars. In addition to the parade, there will also be a King of the Streets hopping competition with a $10,000 prize.
Roberto Hernandez founded the San Francisco Lowrider Council in 1981. He says they put on the parade every year to celebrate the National Hispanic Latino Heritage Month, but also to celebrate a civil rights victory.
We would get citations every weekend. I got arrested 113 times for cruising. I got beat up 3 times. And actually, that's why I formed the San Francisco Lowrider Council back in the late 70s, early 80s, to organize all the lowriders to stand up for our rights, because what they were doing was racial profiling. It was discrimination. We took them to federal court, and we put the city on trial.
Hernandez and his fellow lowriders won a settlement at the time, but statewide bans on lowrider cruising in California weren't lifted until 2023. Arizona legislators blocked a bill last year that would have prevented local bans on cruising. Hernandez says this year's event will take on a different emotional tone.
In this moment right now, more than ever before, we are dedicating this parade to all our immigrant brothers and sisters, and we're inviting them to be a part of it in different ways, because you should not hide. You know, what's going on is criminal. We're standing up against that, and we're saying that, you know, basta ya, you know, that's not right.
The Lowrider Parade and Hopping Competition will be live at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on CBS on Saturday. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. When guitarist John Scofield was a teenager in the suburbs of New York City, he started taking the train into Manhattan to see live music. It was the late 1960s, and he fell in love with the great rock and blues acts of the era, Jimi Hendrix, B.B. King, and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. He saw all of those groups live, and as an aspiring guitarist, he longed to do what they did. But there was one problem. He couldn't sing.
And to just be like a guitar player who didn't sing, mm-hmm. If you were going to do that, it just led right to jazz.
Around this time, Scofield started to seek out new artists on his New York trips. He saw Thelonious Monk, Ornette Coleman, and Joe Henderson play live, and he loved the way they seemed to sing through their instruments. He was hooked, and he has been ever since. Now 73 years old, he's been touring and recording with the biggest names in jazz for decades. He'll be performing at the Musical Instrument Museum this weekend, and I caught up with him recently to talk about his remarkable career. To begin our conversation, I asked him about one of my favorite quotes of his. Talking about falling in love with the music he's dedicated his life to performing, he once said, "What I loved about jazz was that it allowed and encouraged you to have your own voice. It sounded like humanity."
I said that? Wow.
Yeah.
Damn, that sounds good. But I think people all the time, especially people that are not well-versed in jazz, say, well, why do you like jazz? You know, mm-hmm. It's like there's this all this other music that the whole world likes. And I can't explain it other than I guess I was always a bit of a snob, you know.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, you've also said that the tenor saxophonist Joe Henderson was probably your favorite jazz player. What was it about Joe's playing that you resonated with?
Joe really spoke to me personally in his playing because there was a blues element and a modern jazz element, and it swung like crazy. His combination of stuff really spoke to me. And it was sort of all the stuff that I thought maybe I could do if I got good on the guitar. You know, I went to Berklee School after high school in Boston, and at this club, six nights a week, the Jazz Workshop, they had all the bands from New York the national bands. And I heard Joe a bunch there. And Joe was it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up Berklee. That's kind of the next thing I wanted to ask you about, because if I'm following the timeline correctly, this kind of recurring thing starts to happen after you, maybe once you're at Berklee and soon after, where these titans of jazz hear you play and then they invite you to record and tour with them.
Well, it was a long process because I went to Berklee starting in the fall of 1970. And the first couple of years there were just like, holy shit, I've got to get my stuff together. I've got to practice like crazy. I practiced to the point where I dropped out of school after 2 years but I was also starting to work professionally around Boston, which means I was playing $50 weddings and bar mitzvahs.
Sure.
But Jerry Mulligan came to the Jazz Workshop, the club, and wanted to augment his quartet. Uh-huh. And I got the gig, and then he invited me to record with him and Chet Baker. And that was the beginning for me.
What's it like to go from being a kid who, you know, you spend your teenage years going into New York City, seeing these huge, like the biggest names in jazz, and then somebody like Jerry Mulligan taps you and says, I think you're the guy?
Well, you know what? I was just mainly nervous. Mm-hmm. It was hair raising. But, you know, I just grinned and bared it, you know, had a couple of beers or whatever, you know, I just did it. And that kind of challenge when you're young is really, really good, because then you don't get used to it, but you realize that you'll live through it and you just want more of it.
Yeah. Well, so tell me about that feeling then when you end up meeting Miles Davis, who, as I understand it, his first words to you were, oh, you sound good up there. I guess you had just performed. He'd shown up at a club you were playing at. But then one of the next things he said to you was, shut the F up.
Yeah. He said, shut the F up, because I started to really go off on, oh, Miles is so great to meet you. You're my favorite musician. And he's like, shut the F up, you know. But after, you know, playing with Jerry Mulligan and Chet, Billy Cobham, the fusion, incredible drummer, hired me to be in his band. We were on the road then for 2 years after that. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really broke out on the national jazz scene. The 70s were this incredible time for fusion with bands like Billy, but also Return to Forever and Weather Report and the Mahavishnu Orchestra with John McLaughlin and Herbie's Hancock's Headhunters. And these bands were playing to rock audiences, to big, big audiences of kids, you know. So I got in on that, and then was in New York for a couple of years, knew everybody, was a seasoned pro by the time I met Miles.
Got it. And you end up touring with Miles for, I think it's about 3 years.
I joined his band. He hired me to be in his group. And that was your gig, was with Miles. You had to make yourself available whenever he wanted you. So, you know, if we work, you're going to be there all the time and be ready. And if I decide to take a month off, which would happen a lot, you're going to wait for me.
How did that transform your playing, being in the room with Miles and his band at that time?
we talked about music a lot. He mm-hmm. talked to us, the band members, about what we would call, you know, the real stuff, actually creating music and the mindset. Like what I'm doing right now is I'm talking to you and I'm trying to express an idea.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly what it is, but maybe I'll get to something. And that's exactly what we do when we play. You're just listening to yourself and you say, oh, that's not good. I'm going somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
And then stay away from that. And, oh, okay, this one's pretty good. How can I go with that?
Uh-huh.
And then, but you're also trying to not make it sound too forced,
yeah,
to allow it to just come through you. You know, anybody who improvises enough really starts to believe that there's a thing that's happening that's faster than your brain in a way.
So from this point onward, like in the 70s, you're in this period of your life that would seem to continue to this day that you have described as being a, quote, road dog.
I'm a road dog. That's true.
Well, a way that you described being a road dog once that I really liked is you said, sometimes I forget where I am, but it doesn't matter. You just have to make it to the gig. If the flight gets canceled,
yeah,
you rent a car. If the car breaks down, you take a train. And I got the sense with you that everything is worth it somehow if it just means you get to play.
You know, people here, I'm 73 years old. People, you know, that I know that are civilians, so to speak, they're like, why do you do that? You know, and that's, as far as I can see, the only way you get good at it. I mean, the old guys, as we say, the Miles Davis, John Coltrane guys in the 50s worked jazz clubs where they worked from, you know, 9 to 2.
Right.
Playing 40 minutes on, 20 minutes off.
Right.
Every night, and yeah, did, you know, like 2 weeks in Pittsburgh, then went to Chicago for 3 weeks, then Detroit for a week, and then blah, right, on through all the urban centers.
Yeah.
Never got home, played all the time. And I just am addicted to that. I just want to play.
Well, John Scofield will be playing with his friends, Vicente Archer, Gerald Clayton, and Bill Stewart, as Combo 73. They'll be performing twice on Saturday, September 20th at the Musical Instrument Museum. John Scofield, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. Sam, you're kind of like air guitaring along with that number there.
That's as close as I will ever get.
But it looked, and in my head, it sounded terrific.
That's very generous. I've watched far too many YouTube videos of John Scofield.
Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radiohead, so you can sign up for that at theshow.kjzz.org. And follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.